Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Credit and debit cards have reduced the cash in the pockets of many. Still, minor cash transactions among friends and family endure. That's the focus of a new digital payments network that could enable you to use your smartphone to transfer money to another. Consumer finance reporter for the New York Times, Stacey Cowley, recently wrote about this network. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
More than 30 banks have joined to create, is it called Zelle?
Zelle, yes.
Yeah, after 6 years of laying down the foundation, it's ready for launch. What's it going to look like?
Well, basically, this is going to be baked right into the bank's mobile app. So people won't have to download a separate app. It will just start showing up in the next few weeks in their mobile app, generally with a little button saying, you know, tap here to send money, and it will have some Zelle branding around it and a fairly similar look and feel across all of the various banks.
I guess the idea is you can do this between banks, not just within one bank.
Yes, that's the big selling point. A lot of banks have had these kinds of mobile transfer features over the years, but they've typically been limited to sending within the bank or to a small network of partners. What this is intended to do is make this fairly ubiquitous across a number of major banks. So you see competitors, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Chase, all coming together to enable this across their entire network.
How did they all get together on this to collaborate?
Yeah, you don't often see competitors teaming up on these
anywhere.
Sorts of things, so it's certainly unusual. Basically, this was one of those things where they were all kind of going their own way for a number of years, and they finally hit the point where they decided that it was in their collective interest to team up and fight together against other rivals, particularly Venmo, which is now owned by PayPal, has made significant inroads. That's been one that's been quite popular with millennials. So I think the banks saw this as an area where they either had to team up and make this easy for their customers or lose to non-bank rivals.
There, as you said, Venmo's the competition. What would be the difference between Venmo and Zelle?
The big thing is that Venmo is a separate app. You have to separately install it.
Okay.
Set up your bank account information with it and use it outside your bank network. This is banked straight into the bank's mobile apps, so you don't have to do a whole separate setup process. Also, Venmo is currently a little bit slower. If you want to withdraw your money from Venmo and put it into your bank account, that's typically going to take about one business day. The banks are saying that with Zelle, transactions like that will typically only take a few seconds to a few minutes.
And how does it work? So I go, I get my bank app out. I want to, you know, flip the neighbor kid $20 for mowing my lawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what? How much information do I need them to give the app about the neighbor kid?
So the two things you're going to need for someone are either their email address or their mobile phone number. The apps are generally designed to work with your phone's contact information. So if you have someone's phone number and information saved in your phone's contact directory, you'll generally just be able to tap and send money to them using that. If someone's not in your contact directory, again, just their phone number or their email information. And if their bank is a member of the Zelle network, that should come up pretty automatically.
This almost seems too easy. What about hacking potential?
Certainly, that's been one of the reasons this has taken so many years to put together, is the banks really are concerned about security. So there is a number of technical safeguards built into the mobile apps. They've certainly put a lot there to try to protect this, but that's something they will all be keeping a close eye on as this rolls out.
We are talking about mobile apps, the ability to transfer small sums of money between each other in a very casual, informal way, because 30 banks have joined together to create something called Zelle. It's taken 6 years of laying down the foundation. My guest is Stacey Cowley. She's a finance reporter for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What kind of amounts of money are we talking about here?
Each bank's going to be able to set their own limits. What this is really ideally designed for is small and casual transactions. So splitting a dinner check, sending someone $10 to pay for coffee, something like that. But you can do larger transactions with it. Each bank setting their own limits, but generally you'll be able to send a couple $1,000 through it if you have that amount in your account.
Who actually owns Zelle?
So it's owned by a company called Early Warning Services, which is actually a bank-owned consortium. About 7 of the major banks teamed up to form this company. So the banks do own it themselves, but indirectly through this company.
And how did they come up with the 30 banks? Did they just try to get as many as possible involved in it? And that's
pretty
what
much
they ended up with? Yeah.
They originally started this about 6 years ago. Seven or eight banks came together to lay a network called Clear Exchange. That's actually the technical foundation of this. So they started building the railroads or the tracks, if you will, on this about 6 years ago. Then over the years, additional banks came into the fold. And then as they got ready to launch this as Zelle, the consumer-facing brand, they put out a real recruitment push. That's why we've started to see a number of banks joining the networks just in recent months. They're really trying to make this as large a consortium as they can.
Is this a moneymaker for banks?
Interestingly, no. And that's one of the reasons it was so slow to develop, is I think the banks initially hoped that this would, that people would pay, you know, a buck or a quarter or whatever for the convenience of these digital transactions. The problem was that while they were foot dragging for the last several years on putting this out there, the rivals popped up. And they were willing to do this as a loss leader to get customers. So by the time the banks really got into this market, customers were used to a price point of free for this service. Venmo doesn't charge you to do this. So at this point, the banks have said they're doing this for free just as a basic aspect of having a bank account with them. We'll see if that sticks long term, but at the moment, no one's got any plans to charge for this.
What kind of account do you need with the banks to be able to participate?
Generally a checking account.
That's about it.
Yep.
Other countries have had person-to-person payments for some time, and I know it's been a big deal in developing countries where there's no bricks-and-mortar type of banks. Why has it taken so long in the United States? Because they were looking for that profit angle?
Mm-hmm. Two things. I mean, as they say, mother is the necessity of invention. I think countries that don't have the banking infrastructure, it was a lot more urgent for this to get developed. People really demanded it. So that's one reason you saw it taking off faster than here, where we do have this very entrenched system. Also here, there is a whole lot of regulatory and technical hurdles to overcome that are not always the case in some other countries. So that was another thing. But really, it was that the banks could take the time and kind of drag their feet on this a bit, whereas in other places, there was a lot more urgency around it.
You know, for everybody who's read the book, watched the movie, or is watching the series on Hulu, The Handmaid's Tale has put the fear of God into a lot of people when it comes to a cashless society. And I'm just wondering if you've looked into that, the prospects for cash in the future.
An area of active debate and concern after this story ran. I did hear from a handful of readers who were very adamant that they were never, ever going to use these digital payment things and they liked their cash. So I don't think anyone thinks cash is going away entirely anytime soon. But it has been striking how quickly once people start playing with these mobile payments, it tends to be a use case that sticks. I mean, Venmo has grown very, very quickly over the last couple of years. There are certainly a number of times when it's more convenient to just open an app than it is to go to the ATM.
I'm wondering about ads on the app.
Every bank will basically be able to do its own thing. So whatever you're used to seeing in your bank's mobile app is pretty much what you'll continue to see.
And how are the banks prepared? I mean, what are they expecting? I guess probably not an onslaught, but what are they expecting in terms of traffic and this stuff?
They think it's going to be slow and gradual, partially because people are so used to this not being there, that there is a real branding and awareness challenge they face. I was speaking to Wells Fargo and the U.S. Bank, and they both said they're working pretty closely with their bank branching staff to train them on it and to help them sort of make people aware that this is an option. We all expect that, you know, this will be a growth area, but how long it takes is kind of an open question.
Now, I hate dating myself like this, but I was around when ATMs first came out. And I was thought, no, I'm never going to do that. That's stupid. Why would I drive up to a machine when I can go into an air-conditioned, bank? Anyways, I've never been much of a visionary, but I was young, so they're mostly shooting for the millennials at this point and building from there.
That's one of the things the banks are watching closely on this, is this has typically taken off with millennials. That's certainly the market Venmo is most popular with, those 30 and under. But the banks really see this as something that people of all ages can benefit from. So I think one of the things they're focusing on with Zelle is the user education piece of it, of having bank branch employees and things be there to explain to people how to use it and why this might be useful. So it will be interesting to see what the response is among some of the demographics that haven't taking the mobile payments until now.
You know, nothing is free. I mean, it's going to cost the banks and this consortium something to maintain this network, right?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. I mean, this is sort of like the banks figuring out what a core checking account looks like these days. It used to be that paper checks were something you took for granted and a bank was going to have to maintain the cost of that network. Right now, they're kind of viewing this the same way and saying, okay, this is just one of the basic technical things every bank needs to offer as part of its core checking account experience. But we'll see how that plays out over the long term. Banks are certainly good at figuring out how to charge people for things.
That's for sure. And do they have plans to expand beyond that more than 30 banks that are already involved?
Yeah, I think they're continuing to hope that anyone who's not in the consortium will hop aboard.
Could it be banks and savings and loans and credit unions? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, this is fairly open. There are a handful of smaller banks involved in this, and I think the consortium is available to anyone who wants to join in.
And as far as competition goes, is Venmo the only one out there, or are there others?
There are certainly a handful of other options out there. Pop Money, Square Cash or two that have some pickup. And also the phone makers continue to hold out hope that they can get their mobile payment networks off the ground. Apple Pay has certainly been popular for payments within apps and things like that, and they've been rolling out. They recently announced an expansion of their person-to-person payment features. So they're hoping that if you're using your iPhone and paying a friend who has an iPhone, that you'll choose to use Apple Pay. So there are a number of competitors out there also trying to get this market.
Hmm. It's interesting that banks did something that seems actually pretty simple. Have you tried it?
And it does actually work fairly straightforward. I think that was one of the realizations they had over the last 6 years as they've been working on Clear Exchange. That was something that served their purposes more than their customers. It was a little finicky and clunky to set up. You had to like fuss around with it a lot. This is intended to be a pretty quick, simple on-ramp. You really can be up and running with it in just a few seconds.
All right. Well, Stacey Cowley, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Stacey Cowley. She's a finance reporter for the New York Times. We'll publish a link to her article about the 30-plus banks that have joined together to create what is called Zelle. It took 6 years to lay down the foundation, but it's ready to launch, and it's a casual, informal, person-to-person payment option with your bank. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fidget spinners. It's a low-tech ball-bearing device that users rotate between their fingers. They emerged years ago as a way to help people with autism and attention deficit disorder channel nervous energy. And this spring, fidget spinners went viral. Joining us now to talk about that and other news in the world of kids' technology is the editor of the Children's Technology Review, Warren Buckleitner. Welcome back, Warren.
It's good to be with you, Ann.
All right. So I said it's a low-tech thing. Why are we talking about it on Tech Tuesday?
Well, you know, the idea of having something in your hands to keep your fingers busy goes back a long time. Worry beads or prayer beads or I used to have a little pebble that I held in my hand and tossed it back and forth. So it's really kind of something that human beings tend to do.
Mm-hmm. When did you take note of fidget spinners?
Well, I got one as to review, and it had accelerometers in it and batteries, so it kind of fell into the tech category.
Okay.
And I couldn't stop playing with it.
What does it do? What are you doing with it?
Well, I mean, it got to the point where people were saying, take that away from him. It's so annoying. I was hypnotizing my dog with it because it has – I was using a – one that's made by Spin Zips by Zing Toys. And there's a whole bunch out there, but that's Zing is the maker of this. It's about $10. And I was hypnotizing the dog. You know, you can spin really fast, and the lights are, it's kind of like the LEDs in your sneakers. The faster it spins, the brighter the lights. And so it's kind of a cool visual relationship. But at the end of the day, it's a really simple thing. They're ball bearings, and you know, you just get it going, and it's, you can't stop. But it turns out, I started to play with them with some kids, and that's where I learned my best stuff. And it turns out there's a bunch of tricks you can do, and they're sold everywhere now. So if you pick one up, you can use them for like a timer. So you can just get one spinning and compare them and put them in order from the best bearings to the least effective. And then you can like help kids understand how ball bearings work and put a drop of WD-40 on one to see if it makes a change and that kind of thing. So there's some science there, but it's also a fine motor kind of thing.
And it's also been banned in some schools.
Well, you know, I was a teacher, and our job is to make children as miserable as possible. When you take the oath of being a teacher, it says, I will torture children.
take all the fun out of everything.
Anything that could be fun. yeah, you know, there. Of course it's banned.
Why?
Because it can be distracting. So, you know, and it's something kids are really intrinsically motivated in, so they're going to be playing with them under their desks. And I guess it's a good time to start chewing gum in school because everyone will be, they'll forget about that.
Yeah.
But it's distracting. You know, they say it's for children on the spectrum and that kind of thing. You know, the reality is we all like to keep our fingers busy, and it's the great, anytime you're in a boring lecture of any kind, just take one along and take something along, and you'll find yourself, if you play with your change in your pocket, that's a fidget spinner. That's the play pattern. So my hat's off to the people who thought it up, and it is really fun. I mean, they go fast. And
do they make noise?
Yeah, you know, it's like a whirring sound, and there's all kinds of people who are innovating with them, like the one I have has the embedded technologies, but they're very simple, and that's, I think, the genius of them.
They do help people concentrate. I mean, for some people, they're actually therapeutic, right?
You know, I think that's overblown. And as a generalist kind of educator person, I think just keeping your fingers busy, whatever you use, whether it's weaving or knitting or whatever, it can kind of get you into a flow state thing, and that can be relaxing. So I think it's, you know, it's cool. It's, you know, what I'd say is go buy one. They're about $5 to $7. You'll see them all over the place now, and give it a try.
When you say all over the place, you mean in toy shops or what?
Yeah, they're in toy shops. They're in street vendors have them now.
Okay.
You know, they're everywhere. And you can also decorate them. And I've seen kids who have really done some beautiful things with sparkles. And if you make patterns, I'm always looking for teaching opportunities. You can make patterns that will only appear if they're spinning at a certain speed. So it's a great way to experiment with strobing kinds of effects and motion, time, and those kinds of relationships. So they're actually quite a few sort of informal educational opportunities with fidget spinners.
And now that you're not a teacher anymore, you can talk about those.
Right? Let's keep that a secret.
You also wanted to talk about some STEM-related activities that parents can do with their kids this summer. One program you like is called Scratch. It's another coding opportunity. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, Scratch, you know, I'm sure I've talked about it before, but it just keeps getting better and better. There's more, you know, it's a community. First of all, it's free. It's funded by NSF money originally, and it's created by the Lifelong Kindergarten Group at MIT. It has a lot of great theory behind it. It comes right out of Logo and the Papert kinds of thinking about constructivism, constructionism, and that kind of thing. Mm. But it is a powerful language. The reason I like it is I've used it with a lot of children with any kind of hardware. My favorite right now is Chromebooks. So you can, you know, our library bought 10 Chromebooks, and we have Scratch on it. So it runs from the browser. You need a good internet connection, and that's it. You're off. Children can make an account. They can log in, save their work. You can make a group account so you can share with other kids. And developmentally, it works from first grade on up. So there's a lot of sort of art kinds of activities, but you can learn about sprites and then start programming them. And then it has some real powerful ideas like recursion, and you can cut bits of code from other programs, that kind of thing. So it has the community aspect of coding. There are many, many coding activities out there right now that don't go into that depth, and that's why I like Scratch.
You said your library got 10 Chromebooks. I mean, should people call up their libraries to see if they have this installed or what?
Well, I'm a little bit of an outlier there. I'm a trustee of our library, and I've helped create a technology center in our public library. I personally think libraries will and are increasingly playing a role in providing these kinds of activities. I don't know if fidget spinners will be something you can circulate. Hey, maybe librarians should have a fidget spinner under that circulation desk. But,
exactly. Maybe they do.
But I think Chromebooks and Scratch, and I think also VR systems and that kind of thing should be on the public, accessible to public, people who can't afford those kinds of experiences.
Another summertime project you recommend is making and editing videos for YouTube. Why do you like that idea?
Well, it's real. I think that connecting children to real publishing, in other words, it's pretty easy to shoot video these days. A lot of kids are shooting video or taking pictures, but you really need to start thinking about what do we do with it. Mm-hmm. I personally like stop motion kinds of activities, so taking a series of still photos and turning it into an animated project and then publishing it to YouTube. So if you haven't yet, you know, I think every year, every summer, for example, you should carve out a goal and say, I'm going to try to master this. And I think YouTube is a great family project. Obviously, YouTube needs to be used with a lot of supervision, but it's very powerful. And you can publish things as unlisted projects, so only people with a link can see it, and that kind of thing. And when children can make a video project, whether it's just a short bit of video, like my daughter just sent me a short clip of her puppy, or if it's like a stop motion thing where they're doing claymation or something like that, then they can share it. And then if it's really cool, they can publish it and start getting into the idea of, you know, you can put ads with it, you can start to make money from it, and perhaps pay for that college tuition. But it's powerful. And I think that, you know, being by your child's side while they experiment with social media is a smart thing to do.
What about editing tools? What do you recommend?
Well, I love iMovie. And, you know, I think it's, of course, if you're using an Apple, it's hard to beat that. You can also use, with YouTube, for example, there's built-in editing tools. So you can do things like trim and add, put elements like text elements in. You can also take out shaky video and that kind of thing. I sort of breathe iMovie, and I've found it to be incredibly affordable and powerful.
The whole thing. Well, let's talk about some apps now, and the best apps for kids. One that you're recommending for ages 6 to 8 is Puppet Pals Storybooks Commander. It's called Puppet Pals Storybooks Commander Amazing. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, that, if you've ever seen the Puppet Pals, there's the idea that you can take a bunch of characters and you can move them around the screen and talk, and their lips move because the microphone is hearing that linkage between your voice and the object on the screen is really powerful. It connects a lot of things in terms of auditory and speaking skills. And so Puppet Pals was one of the original programs back in 2008 or 9 when the iPhone was out. I reviewed the first Puppet Pals, and I fell in love with it. And then programs like Toontastic came out, and Toontastic 3D, which is also an amazing program. But the folks at Polished Play, who make Puppet Pals, didn't sit on their hands. They started to make these stories, these themed stories. So if you just go into iTunes or Google Play and you type Puppet Pals, you can download one of these. It's a paid app, so it's worth the couple bucks. But there are different themes. So I think I mentioned one of the one out of the library that it's the Commander Amazing. There's actually four in the series, so you can kind of look at the pictures and see what theme you like. Just try one, and I guarantee you'll love it. And you can make videos that you can post to your new YouTube channel.
And you can paste your face onto the main characters.
Yeah, and it's really clever. It's kind of like the Toca Boca I forgot the name of it, but where you can pull your face in and or put your dog's face in, that kind of thing. And very clever idea, because your lips move with your voice, and it's really a strong.
Is it kind of like Jib Jab, what they used to do?
It looks a lot like Jib Jab, but
okay.
Jib Jab has become increasingly commercial, where you get to create something and then you have to pay to share it.
Yeah.
This doesn't do that.
Okay. That's Puppet Pals Storybooks, Commander Amazing. And another app you like is one that gets kids into coding again. It's called Code Carts. That's carts with a K. What's going on with that?
Yeah, that's from Edoki Academy, and it's just out. And again, there's a lot of these coding kinds of programs where you move a sprite from one side of the screen through a maze. What this does is it gives you a racing metaphor, and the carts are racing cars. And so your idea is to get your car to the finish line, and you need to drag and drop tiles to do that. And it's a very easy to use sort of, the training wheels for beginning coding. And I like the 70 tracks, and there's two modes where you can race against the computer or the microprocessor.
Your review said that the app has a well-designed tutoring function in the early levels. How important is that?
That's really important, and it's the kind of thing where I think if Maria Montessori were around today, she'd say, why not put the tutor in the experience where, because it can tell if you're struggling, and this does that. Edoki Academy is made by... it's designed by former Montessori teachers, and so they're very tuned in to helping the child if they struggle. And it might be sort of just like a ghost hand shows up to say, hey, move this here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like to discover those kinds of features inside of an experience. So that's called Code Carts, and it's K-A-R-T-S. It's out this week.
Is there any evidence that these types of coding apps for kids – the ones I play with, actually get kids interested in computer coding?
I think that coding is one of those words that gets misused quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What this experience is, and a lot of experiences, it's really spatial problem solving. I mean, you got to move through a maze, right? And so anytime you play with a maze, are you coding? I think that it's important to, there's a lot of hype. My friend Robin Raskin calls coding the new Mandarin Chinese. It's kind of sexy to teach your kid coding. Think about what your children are actually doing. That's why I like Scratch, because Scratch is sort of real coding, and don't be afraid to introduce the real stuff. Get your child into Unity if they're in maybe sixth or seventh grade, so they can actually make apps. There's another program that Apple is promoting called Swift, and it's the actual language that It's called Swift Playgrounds. Their plan is to, you know, get kids into making apps for their hardware. Swift will not work on Android, so there's definitely a business agenda. Mm-hmm. But it is the real deal, and it's powerful. So coding is, you know, it can range from, you know, moving through a maze to much more sophisticated kinds of activities.
Another app you like teaches biology. It's called Mammals, and kids can use it to explore the physiology of different kinds of animals, right?
Yes. I'm so glad that we're talking about it. I always give us more to talk about than we. So Mammals by Tiny Bop. And Tiny Bop, you know, it's got it's one of the leading studios. It's in Brooklyn.
You've talked about Tiny Bop a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I love them. And it lets you explore the insides of different animals. One of my favorites is the elephant. You do this cross-section, and you can see the bones, the circulatory system, the nervous system, that kind of thing. And then put the elephant in different situations, like feed it and see how the food goes through the digestive system. The thing that's amazing about this one, now get ready, because I know this is a PG rated show, but this elephant is pregnant. So there's a little baby elephant that you see inside this mother elephant, and you can actually see the birth process. It's
wow.
All done without gore and so on, but it really is fascinating. And so it's called Mammals by Tiny Bop. I highly recommend it. The $3 download.
How, what age groups are you looking at with that?
That's the kind of thing where even a preschooler, you know, the minimum user competency, or in other words, the skills needed are preschool.
Mm-hmm.
They can like poke at the bones and see what things do. I think it's the kind of app you should have on your child's tablet so they can discover it. But it's best, most of the content is best for the middle elementary years.
Okay. Warren Buchleitner, we are out of time now, so sure. I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Anne. It's always good to talk with you.
Warren Buchleitner, editor of Children's Technology Review. More coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you're still stumped for gift ideas for Father's Day, Russell Holly, a father himself and contributing editor for Android Central, has some ideas. Welcome back, Russell Holly.
Thank you.
One item on your list is for the dad who likes to barbecue but does not want to be tied to the grill. Tell us about the iGrill Mini.
So this is a simple Bluetooth thermometer, basically. It plugs into, you take the thermometer in, you stick it in whatever meat it is you want to measure. The other side of it kind of hangs outside of the grill on one of the countertops you have there. And as long as you're, you know, within range of this thing, you know, if you're doing something else in the backyard, like playing with your kids or something, then you can check from your phone what the temperature is of the, you know, the thing that you're keeping an eye on.
How much does it cost?
They are $45 most places. Amazon has them for between $45 and $50, and they're Amazon Primeable, so you can actually have them delivered before Father's Day.
Ha-ha. Another idea you have is one that also relates to the outdoors. It's a water-resistant Bluetooth speaker from the company called Villain. What's the deal with that?
So this speaker in particular, there are a lot of, you know, kind of outdoorsy Bluetooth speakers that can survive being flashed and you know, have pretty decent sound. This one has both of those things, as well as a 7,000 milliamp hour battery baked in. You can actually charge your phone or, you know, a Bluetooth headset or something like that while you are also, you know, playing music. that made it particularly useful for me.
And the cost?
If you want the version that has the 7,000 milliamp hour battery, they start at $40, also on Amazon.
Okay.
And that gets you, if you're not charging your phone, that's about 20 hours straight of music playtime.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Father's Day gift ideas in the tech end of things with Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, also a father. So hopefully he'll get some of these goodies. If you have a question or comment for Russell Holly, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Make sure you get your call in quickly. Russell Holly usually can answer the question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Russell Holly, you also suggest the Amazon Echo Dot as an inexpensive gift for dads. It's a smart speaker without the speaker, right?
Well, it does have a speaker in it. It's just a very quiet one compared to what you would see in most other kind of connected speaker things. But the thing that makes this special is that it has a 3.5 millimeter jack in the back of it, so you can connect really any speaker that you want, including just feeding it into a larger stereo system in your house if you have one of those, so that you can add all of the kind of Amazon streaming capabilities to the, you know, a larger, more capable speaker that you might have in your house.
Why is this a good Father's Day gift? It sounds like a good me gift.
Well, it really is a good everybody gift, but the big thing about the Echo Dot in particular is it's a great way to, particularly for my dad, it's a great kind of starting point to see, how much you want to kind of grow into, connecting your home to things. My dad is not the most tech-savvy person, but I got him one of these last year, and he uses it constantly for things like to-do lists around the house, or if he wants to, send messages to one of us kids, because we all also have Echo Dots, and so it has its own kind of internal messaging service now, and he has entirely too much fun with that, particularly when it comes to playing with grandkids. But it's really just kind of, it's an inexpensive way to explore whether you actually want to, start connecting your home to your digital life, basically.
You know, it was interesting that some of your ideas were not particularly high tech, including the Captain America robe. Is this something that you're pining for, Russell Holly?
No, this is something that I'm embarrassed to say I own. really, just because we are a Marvel household here, and so anytime there's a new thing, my kids and my partner are very eager to introduce it to the household. But the biggest reason that this was added to the list is it's actually soon to not be sold anymore from ThinkGeek. They were originally $60, and they're actually $20 now on their website. So if you wanted something that was quick and inexpensive, you can't get it overnight shipped like you would from most things from Amazon, but it's at ThinkGeek.com for the Captain America robe, not from this past movie, but it's actually the outfit that he wore in the movie before, if you care about that sort of thing.
Well, I do care about your opinion about Wonder Woman.
Oh, it was delightful. I had so much fun. I can't wait to take my daughter to see it. I have not been able to do that yet, and I am looking forward to doing that this weekend.
Let's see. Aaron in Dublin, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Awesome. My question is about the active father or the triathlete. What sort of gadgets or things are out there that are new that we could do for them?
What do you think, Russell Holly, for the athletic dads out there?
Well, the first thing that I usually lean towards without knowing a whole lot more about the dad is a fitness tracker. You know, there are a couple of different options there. If that dad is a fan of the more, more information on the wrist and something that takes up a lot of space on the wrist, like a traditional watch, then the Fitbit Blaze is usually the thing that I end up recommending. If there's something that they're not a big fan of something taking up a lot of space on the wrist, or they want something lightweight and they absolutely want to make sure that it works in the water, Misfit has something called the Shine, which is designed to work specifically for triathlons. It works, you know, on water, on bike, and while you're running. That's usually a pretty good recommendation for me.
All right. Thanks, Aaron, for that call. The new gaming console from Microsoft, details have been trickling in about that. What do we know about the Xbox One?
Yeah, so it is weirdly called the Xbox One X, which means...
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Its initials actually spell out Xbox, which, you know, kind of made me cringe a little bit. But so it is called the Xbox One X. It was originally known as Project Scorpio for a lot of people who were following, you know, this thing that would be the next Xbox. And it was really designed as competition or you know, kind of a way of one-upping Sony's latest version of the PlayStation 4 Pro. And this is a higher-end version of the Xbox that does not replace the existing Xbox, but really just a higher-end version for people who have 4K televisions and are really interested in you know, higher-resolution gaming. But it doesn't replace the existing Xbox. So it's really, you know, Sony and Microsoft both have created this kind of new way to sell their products, where they have, you know, this console that's for everyone, and now this higher end console that you may want to spend more money on if you're already spending more money on, you know, kind of the best home entertainment center you can.
$499, that's the price. Some are saying that's too much.
It's definitely high. You know, this is something that Microsoft caught a lot of flack for last year, where, you know, the original Xbox One was sold with the you know, Kinect camera initially for $500, and they caught so much heat for that that they ended up removing the camera from the box, selling it at a lower price in order to kind of compete with Sony. We're seeing it again here at this higher end price, which is, you know, they also did a price reduction of their Xbox One S, you know, during this conference, which is now exactly half the price, so $250. But again, you know, this is Microsoft's goal. They wanted to create, you know, this Xbox for everyone, and then this Xbox for higher end users, and they're keeping that price point as a way of differentiating those types of gamers, I suppose.
Resolution graphics seem to be a big deal with the future of gaming. Why do you think? I mean, it's the way it's been going for a long time, but now it's picky.
Well, we always have two separate camps when it comes to that in gaming. There's never not been two camps. You know, the people who want the most realistic graphics as possible, they want to really look at the television and almost feel like they're watching a movie when they're playing the game. And so, you know, you have, you know, and Microsoft has always been very focused on that with games like Halo and Call of Duty and games like that are very focused on being hyper-realistic. And then you have companies like Nintendo who are releasing brand new consoles that don't have 4K connection at all. Most of their games are highly animated and not at all focused on the best possible graphics, but rather the smoothest overall, you know, visual experience when playing. And so there's always been these kind of two camps, and you know, Microsoft leans very heavily in one direction, and Sony leans very heavily in the other direction. Or, sorry, Nintendo leans very heavily in the other direction, and Sony kind of sits in the middle and releases something for both sides. But yeah, that's the goal here with the Xbox One X, is to continue that push into, you know, the sort of hyper-realistic gaming.
Is VR, is virtual reality, going to be part of the mix for the Xbox One X?
There was a lot of talk early on about there being virtual reality support for the X, for what they were calling Project Scorpio, but Microsoft did not make any announcements on stage about, you know, any of the virtual reality efforts coming from Microsoft. You know, they have been making announcements for what's called mixed reality. And there was a lot of assumption that those headsets would come to the Xbox One X, but there hasn't been anything confirmed. It's something that we probably won't hear anything about until 2018.
In other gaming news, Minecraft, the popular building game, is going to be expanding so that you can play across different devices. I mean, that's just so you can move from your smartphone to your laptop to your TV or what?
No, this is all about playing with friends.
Okay.
If you have a friend who has been playing Minecraft on their PC for the last 5 years and has the biggest, most expansive world possible, and you have a younger brother who maybe has only ever played Minecraft on a phone or on a tablet, they can now play in the same world, which had not previously been possible. They were very separate initially, where, you know, kind of the Xbox version was its own version and the phone version was its own version and the PC version was its own version. But starting with this next big update that's coming out, all versions of the Minecraft game, with one exception, will be cross-platform, and they'll all be able to kind of play with each other and enjoy.
But you can't play on PlayStation. What's going on?
There is a Minecraft version for PlayStation, so you can play on the PlayStation, but there is no cross-compatibility between Minecraft on the Xbox and Minecraft on the PlayStation. And it's not entirely clear why. There's a lot of speculation that Sony and Microsoft just could not come to an agreement. That both parties felt benefited. But whatever the reason, those two consoles are still not quite in a place where they're playing with one another. They don't play nice in the same sandbox, I guess.
Who do you think's gonna lose out on that?
Honestly, I think Sony will probably lose out on that because Microsoft owns Minecraft. So, the updates for new features and things like that, they're obviously going to come out to Microsoft partners for this project first. So it's likely that the PlayStation version of Minecraft will just never be quite as feature complete or as fun to play as the other versions. And it's possible that before long, Sony will hear the cries from their fans to fix this, and they'll reach out to Microsoft and find some kind of agreement. But at least initially, that's not going to be the case.
Last week, we didn't have time to discuss a new smartphone. It's called Essential Phone. What's the story behind the phone and its creator, Andy Rubin?
So Andy Rubin is, for all intents and purposes, the creator of Android, the Android operating system.
Oh, okay.
He was working on Android as this kind of standalone project, and then Google bought the company that he owned that was working on the Android operating system, and continued to run the Android program at Google for several years. And then left to work on other projects at Google for a while before going out and starting his own company. Essential is the name of the new company that he has started with the purpose of approaching Android from a hardware perspective instead of a software perspective. So he's looking at building a phone that does things kind of unique and unlike any other phone that is being built right now. And it includes a couple of really interesting and kind of bizarre hardware decisions. The first of which being that the front-facing camera of the phone is actually inside the display. So when you look at the screen, when you look at your normal phone, the camera is usually kind of up in one of the corners and above the display.
Uh-huh.
And in this new version, it's actually down in between parts of this display. So there's this little notch that's cut out of the display where the camera is actually resting and staring at you. And the biggest reason for doing something like that is so when you are having a video chat with someone, the person that you're having a video chat is, really looks like they're looking at you. A big problem with a lot of video chat services where the camera is elsewhere is if someone is looking at the screen and see you on the screen, they're not looking up at the camera. And so it doesn't look like they are, looking you in the eye.
Uh-huh.
And that can be very kind of off-putting. And this might fix that.
It says something about the future of how this will be integrated into our everyday lives.
It's really interesting. This is something you see in all the sci-fi, everything science fiction.
Right.
When someone's doing a video chat of some kind, there's never a camera to look at. They're always looking at the screen. And so this could be the first push towards that being real. Or it could just be a really weird camera built into a phone. We don't know that.
Maybe we could talk about that a little bit more later. But Russell Holly, for now, that's all the time we have. And thank you so much for joining us as usual.
It's been a pleasure.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. Thanks for listening today. This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.